You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Find more great shows like this at WeAreLibertarians.com. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. This is another episode, a special series here on the We Are Libertarians podcast called The Path to Libertarianism, where we talk to prominent libertarians and hear how they end up in the libertarian camp. And along the way, we end up having a lot of fascinating conversations about a bunch of different topics. So make sure you go check it out on YouTube, check it out on the podcast feed. And today, I'm really excited about this conversation because this is somebody that I've wanted to talk to for years. His name is Stefan Kinsella, and he is he founded the Center for the Study of Innovative Freedom. Let me just read his bio, because the bio alone, you're just like, wow, he's done a lot here. He's the founder and executive editor of the Libertarian Papers website and founder and director of the Center for the Study of Innovative Freedom, editorial board of Reason Papers, editorial advisory board of Molinari Review. He's worked with Fee and the Mises Institute and so many other different – we could go on and on. Thank you so much for joining us, Stefan. I appreciate it so much.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for hosting me and for having your podcast.
Yes.
Very nice.
And my apologies, Stefan. We were talking off air about your name, and people mess it up, and Stephanie, and which I can't imagine accidentally calling you Stephanie. But
I'm never called Stephanie on accident. That's actually a way. I get called Steffi by my buddy, Steffi Baby or Steph. You know, that's fine. It doesn't matter. I get called Steve, Stephon. There was a basketball player at Louisiana called – I'm from Louisiana. It's called Stephon Johnson, Steffond, one of these, bastardized names, whatever.
Well, you said you're from Louisiana.
Your name's pretty phonetic, so you don't care.
Chris, no, Spangle, Chris.
Right? So, like, yours is phonetic.
You'll occasionally get that, like, is that with a K? And I'm just like, no.
Yeah, when we had our son about 17 years ago, I sat down and I tried to narrow down the list of names to names that are normal, only have one pronunciation, only have one spelling, are phonetic, are not that common, etc. Like, you can, like, there's only three left. There was Ryan, Ian, and Ethan. So we pick Ethan. I mean, there's nothing else for boys. Everything else, there's a problem with everything else. John, Jonathan, Hank, Henry, you know, all these fancy names. There's a problem with everything. Chris.
Okay. With a K-R-I-S. And apologies.
Well, not only that, some women are named Chris, so it's like androgynous. So, it's like, it's hard to find the perfect name. Of course, there's other problems in life.
Many. So let's go back.
You deal with whatever name you have.
Yeah. So we always start with kind of what your family of origin was. You know, did you come from a political family? You said you grew up in Louisiana. I mean, where did your was it a political house?
Well, so the funny thing is, so I'm adopted. I'm from Louisiana, although I'm such a Randian, not a Randian anymore, really, but I'm such a curmudgeon, contrarian, like individualist. Like, I hate to say I'm an American, right? I even hate to say I'm a human. I'm just like a sentient being, like among all the others that are in the world, in the universe. Okay, I'll say I'm an earthling, okay?
All right.
I happen to be an American, but I don't like these identities that are foisted on you by accidental circumstances that you don't choose, like being an American or being I'm from Louisiana. I was born there, but I've lived in Texas and London and Pennsylvania and other states longer than I have in Louisiana. So, I don't know. I guess it matters where you're from. But the funny thing is, my first name, so I was adopted, and later on I had this whole adoption story, which I'm going to write up someday, when my birth mother found me when I was 30 years old. And so my original name was not, so my name is Norman Stephen Kinsella. So I have a grandfather, which is Irish. Kinsella is an Irish name, right? I think my dad used to tell me it meant, think about the word Kinsella. It sounds something like whatever, but he said it means king of the islands. Okay, that's what he said, you know, because everyone tries to glorify their ancestry, right?
Right.
And it's not even my ancestry because I'm adopted, but that's what the story was. But I looked into it later, and Kinsella in Gaelic means dirty head. Or unclean head, which doesn't mean like a physically dirty scalp. It means like having, you know, unclean thoughts, which is probably pretty accurate for me. Conventional life. If you're a libertarian, you have unclean. So Kinsella might be actually approved. But my original name was not Norman Stephen Kinsella. It was the name I was given by my birth mother until a month or two later when I was adopted and my parents changed it. But it was Farrell Wayne Doiron, Doiron. When I met my birth mother when I was 30, she said, if you don't know how to spell Doiron, think of it as do iron. Like do iron, D-O-I-R-O-N, like, okay, fine, thank you. But anyway, my first name was Farrell. But, and she gave me this weird name on purpose because she tried to find me later and she thought she would leave these breadcrumbs for finding me later. It was a whole story. But anyway, I was just a little kid in Louisiana, rural Louisiana, and nice parents, adopted, but that doesn't make a difference when you're adopted because you think you're normal. I was smart and apolitical. So my family was like blue dog Democrat, like conservative, but normal, you know? And so politics was never part of anything. It was just, I mean, I heard a few rumors, like when I registered to vote, when I was 18, when I registered, you have to, you know, you get your driver's license and then you become 18. And you get your first voter card. That was for me. That was like 1983 or something like that. I registered Democrat actually because my parents were Democrats, and they said that's for the people, and the other parties for the. But they were all Republican or conservative, in essence, right?
Right, because at that point it was very fluid in terms of what party you were in. It was more local than it was this.
Well, national. I just went to register to vote, and I had to declare. So I was a Democrat at first, but I've never voted Democrat in my life. Which I'm proud of. I did vote for Reagan in 1984. My first vote as president was 84, Reagan's second term. But ever since then, I voted. Well, I don't actually vote that much anymore, but I voted for libertarians after that. But anyway, from my perspective now as a libertarian, and I'm into libertarianism, I'm really into it, right? But I think what happened was I was in a rural state, Louisiana. You know, everyone is in an environment which is not that intellectual. Okay. I mean, people are just normal. Then you have the dorks and the geeks and, you know, whatever. And I was sort of ripe for ideas, philosophy, pyramid power, UFOs, you know, psychic theory, whatever. I was like looking for something beyond this sort of, you know, sports LSU football kind of thing, whatever. And so in high school, so here's what happened. And I've written this in an article, which is a chapter in the Walter Block book on, Walter Block has a good book on libertarians giving their stories about how they became libertarians. Like why I chose libertarian. I forgot what the title is.
Why I Chose Liberty.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So, and my chapter's in there. And so I've already explained this. So what happened for me, so if you're asking the story, I think what happened, and at the time I didn't realize it because, you know, I realize it now, but I think I was a little kid, a smart kid, a bullied kid. And the adoption thing, the reason I mentioned that is because I think that made me be individualist in the sense of I don't care what my nationality or my genes are because I didn't even know. So I don't rest on that. I rest on whatever I accomplish, whatever. And I was smart, so that's what I accomplished, whatever, you know. So so when I read – so I was at a Catholic private high school in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the librarian and I got along, and she could see that I was, you know, needing some more meat. And she said, you should read Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead. It's like 10th grade or 11th grade. And she wasn't even a Randian. She was just some smart lady who could see something. And I think her name was Miss Reinhardt. I think she changed my life because I read The Fountainhead, and it blew my mind, right, as a 10th grader or 11th grader. And then I started reading everything, Anthem, and then I started reading everything else, you know, Henry Hazlitt and Milton Friedman and Rothbard and Mises and all the other stuff. So I started becoming really – so from my point of view, I was a nothing. I was never a lefty. I was never a Democrat. I was really – I was never a socialist. I was just some guy that came from an apolitical nothing. And so I came from like the vacuum, like tabula rasa. And so to me, Rand and that stuff that she referred to in footnotes, I think is what shaped me. And then it went from there. You know, in college, I studied engineering, but in the side, I was reading like in the library, the Ayn Rand letters and Kant and history and sociology and philosophy and all these things. And I think I was a frustrated engineer because I loved engineering and I was good at it. But I, like top of my class, I loved it and it was a practical career. But I just couldn't see being an engineer, you know, for me.
Yeah,
for
so let me ask you this because it seems to be a an interesting component of libertarianism that you don't see maybe in the Republican Party. You know, there's a conservative, you know, tradition, and you've got Buckley and you've got some of that movement. You've got some on the left. But there's something about libertarianism that once you start digging into it, you start falling down so many different rabbit holes, and there's so many intellectual treats. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's true of some people, right? And that's the people that you notice. I mean, there's lots of people that, of course, don't do that. They're like there are some people that I meet, and I'm not trying to sound condescending, but they, I mean, because they will tell me this. They'll say, like, listen, I don't think I have good reading comprehension, or I just don't read books, and I can't do that. But, like, they have leanings, right? But other people, I don't know what it is. I think it depends upon the person. There's something about – and there's something maybe messed up about it to some degree because lots of libertarians are, you know, they're not the most prolific, productive people in the universe, but they're my people. They're my peeps, as I said in a recent podcast. I think that for me – for me, it was the individualism of The Fountainhead and just the fact that you can learn things from books, right? Or from – and this was way before the internet and all this kind of stuff, right? So now everything is different. I don't know. I think the libertarian phenomena is interesting, and I'm always interested, like you, in people's stories about how they came to it. For me, I think I came to it because I wanted to and my story I think is not typical because most libertarians that I know of and respect and admire and are friends with, they're not like – I'm not that prominent. I mean, I'm not famous, but I've kind of – carved out a niche of academic stuff in a certain field. So, and I enjoy that, and I use that, and I manipulate in these waters. But lots of my friends are like a level or two, I won't say below me, but like they don't do that. They go to the conferences, we talk, we go to dinner parties, but they're just part of the milieu, but they're not doing it, right? It appealed to me because I just loved learning, and I loved personally the whole process of this whole academic process of footnoting. Like when you have a scholarly article where you footnote things and you reference everything, like that kind of thing. Now I know there's a bunch of bullshit about it, and a lot of it's fake, and a lot of it is fluff. But I like that, and I was kind of good at it. And you have to kind of be good at it if you're a certain type of lawyer. So it's weird that my legal career, my practical career, sort of complemented my hobby, you could call it, because I could publish an article on philosophy or legal philosophy or political philosophy or something like that, which sounded a little bit like a normal legal law review article, and it was maybe in a law review, and it would satisfy the partners at the law firm. Oh, hey, you're doing what you should do to make your way in this way. But they're not the same. They're not the same. And I think I've gotten off track, but, and I hate to talk about myself, by the way, because I'm not a great guy or anything, but I'm just, I do like when I talk to someone who has the right interest or the right niche, like a young kid, if they want advice, sometimes they really want advice. It's rare that you find someone you can give the right advice to, because it's rare to have a match, right? But between someone who can give the right kind of life advice for someone, depends on where they're going. But on occasion this happens, and that's what I like to do when I can.
So let me ask this, you know, when you're talking about that intellectual pursuit and, you know, what does your information diet look like as you're putting together these articles, as you're putting together, you know, a scholarly piece and footnoting and working on a paper or just even your daily reading habits when you're trying to understand and give context to the world? What is your daily intellectual habit like?
Well, so now it's different than in the past, of course, because of the internet and because of all of the – so the internet distracts me. So, like, I think I'm way less productive in the last several years than I probably could have been, because I'm just always obsessed. I mean, I'm too into the internet, but that's a personal issue. On the other hand, there's way more information you can get.
Yeah. I'm so with you. Yeah, it's harder to read than it used to be because you're like, oh – what's the serotonin device
so
up
much,
to?
There's so many distractions. And Everyone complains, modern technology is distracting people. I'm like, yeah, but that's like an embarrassment of riches. So But when I was younger, I had these weird – I was very, very – and I see this now as the older guy who looks upon my previous things. I was extremely disciplined. I would have a law job during the day and with my wife. Now, this is before I had a kid, really. When I had a kid, things changed, like having children. So if you're just married and have a nice, successful, young professional career and you're – and I combined it with this intellectual life, which was writing articles and editing things. And when I started these law firms in Houston and then Philadelphia, you know – the law firms were amazingly, in a way, generous in the sense that they would support anything you want to do that has any kind of plausible connection towards business development, they call it, or career development, right? So some lawyers, they will do, you know, they'll take people out to dinner and they'll schmooze people and try. So you try to get clients, right? It's called business development. But some people, they'll give speeches at the bar associations, and some will write articles for law reviews, right? They become like – so there's different ways you get your name out there. And, of course, I did the latter, and two-thirds of that was really libertarian stuff disguised as law. Yeah, but I got – so I would be at these law firms in Houston and then Philly and then back in Houston the second time – And we had these departments of helpers that you could, they could do whatever you wanted, and you could charge it to a non-billable account. A non-billable account is a is an account that the firm will pay for, but it's not billable to a client. Mm. But they let you have a certain – in fact, they encourage it because they want you to do non-billable things like speaking and teaching and promoting something, right? So I was going to the Mises Institute in Auburn, and they were paying for the plane rides. I mean, like – and funny. I was totally honest. I never have been dishonest. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to an Austrian economics conference in Auburn, Alabama from Philadelphia. And you guys are going to pay for the hotel and the plane fare and the fee. And you understand that I'm giving a talk on why we should abolish copyright law. And they're like, oh, fine. That's great. You guys, you have some get go. You have some mojo. You have some get up and go. You have some ambition. They didn't care if they didn't know. So I did all that kind of stuff, but then I would get the librarians to go to all these libraries for me. Like every time I found a footnote in an article that seemed like a potential source of stuff I needed to learn, I would just write it down, send it to these paralegals in the department, and they would go to a library. And if they didn't have the local Pennsylvania library or whatever, they would do an interlibrary loan. Then they photocopy it, and so I had this stack of articles. I think they all thought I was crazy, but the partners didn't care because they weren't paying for it. And, you know, supporting his research and his. So I developed this huge arsenal of research. It was like, I mean, it's probably 20 feet long if you let it. It was like tons of legal articles, philosophy journal articles, sociology, but mostly mostly law review articles. And chapters of books. And then I paid someone to scan it all for me. So I have it all on my computer because I went digital. But that's kind of it's a fun part of my career. It's like I was like really vigorous in sinking my teeth into everything. And I remember I would sit at my computer. Honestly, I can hardly remember how I got on the internet because I remember we didn't have Wi-Fi at the time. You had to like plug an Ethernet cable into your computer. I mean, like, yeah, remember.
God forbid your mom was on the phone with somebody. That's when I was a kid. That she was on a phone call and you wanted to get on the internet to talk to your girlfriend. That era was rough. People don't even understand.
That was earlier. I remember that too. That was when I was in college or law school. I remember I would be like on the modem and like doing this kind of connection, and then someone pick up the phone, they screw my connection up. No, I just mean after that, when you had a dedicated cable, it was an Ethernet connection, but you didn't have Wi-Fi yet. So you had to have your computer connect. So like the whole thing is a jumble. And anyway, I'm rambling a little bit, but let me go back for a second because I think I've gotten even more on a tangent, on a tangent, on a tangent. Basically, I loved and discovered economics and philosophy and the liberty philosophy when I was in high school and college. And one reason I switched from engineering, not switched, but I went from engineering to law school was because I started loving this mode of thinking. And it has worked out well for me in my personal life and my personal career. But in the same time, I was developing my contacts and my connections and my thoughts, right, and my writing with the Mises Institute and other seminars and things like that. So all that happened for me from, like, say, 1994 to now. So that's kind of where I've ended up. And at this current point in time, I'm kind of quasi-retired, mostly retired, still do some patent law, but I'm still trying to write books and get the ideas out there for liberty and for understanding of property rights and free market ideas. That's kind of where I am right now.
So let's hop back to when you were an objectivist, because I read an article, I think I'll put it in the show notes. I think it was on LouRockwell.com about you know, going from an objectivist to an anarcho-capitalist. And many of our listeners may not know what the two of those things even are, the distinction, because I think people look at it and they go, oh, Ayn Rand's a libertarian, Murray Rothbard's a libertarian. It's all the same thing. What is the distinction between the two, and what made you transition from one to another?
Okay, so I'll give my – okay, and again, I hate to talk about myself because here's my own perspective on it and my own history and my take on it given what I've been through. The way I look at it right now is that libertarianism, which is part of my identity, okay, is a broad movement, and we can – be gracious and include minarchists in that. Now, I'm an anarchist libertarian now, and I don't think minarchist libertarians are true libertarians. I think they're flawed. But still, I think that according to the definition, they're part of our umbrella. Okay. And I think what happened was Ayn Rand, who's a minarchist in a sense.
And can you explain that term for those who don't know?
Okay, so the way I look at this, and a lot of libertarians look at it, is there's two types of libertarians, anarchists and minarchists. So there's people, libertarians, that believe in radically limited government and state functions, and those that believe that everything the state does is illegitimate, right? So that's anarchists. And the minarchists would be the minimal state advocates. And those are people like Robert Nozick, or Ayn Rand, although she wouldn't use that word. And then on the outside edge of that would be the classical liberals like Milton Friedman and I won't say Ronald Reagan, but, you know, like people that believe in limited government but not really ultra. I mean, if you read Robert Nozick, Nozick's Anarchy, State, and Utopia, you'll see all these terms like minimal state, night watchman state. There's all these synonyms people use. But the point is, the libertarian movement comprises, at the current point in time, I believe, people that are anarchist. In other words, people that believe in individual rights to such a consistent extent that they think that the state itself or government itself is always a criminal enterprise, which is my belief, by the way. Or people that think that, well, like they believe in the Constitution and the Founding Fathers and the American ideal or something like that, right? Some very, very small state, they'll call it, right? But the state needs to be there for some purposes. Those we call those minarchists, right? So, of course, in the libertarian movement, there's those differences. So when I started out, I was a nothing. I wasn't a lefty who became right or vice versa, like my greatest mentor would be, say, Hoppe, Hans Hermann Hoppe. And he was a lefty because he was born in 1949 in Germany. His birthday was 2 days ago, September 2nd. So happy birthday, Hans. But he was a lefty at first, and then he became a Rothbardian, Misesian libertarian. I came from nothing. I came from, like, really tabula rasa. I came from tabula rasa, and I started being interested by Rand, which she's what you might call a minarchist. So I thought, okay, you need a government, and the libertarians are evil because they don't have a philosophy. You know, I bought into all the Rand crap for about 8 months or whatever it takes to grow out of that stuff, you know. And so just to be honest, and I still admire a lot of what Rand did. But then I read Rothbard and Hazlitt and Bastiat and Molinari and lots of other people. And I realized, and the Tannehills, like the Market for Liberty about the Tannehills, you know, like, I'm like, actually I'm a libertarian and actually I'm an anarchist, you know? So that's how it happened for me in my personal, like, development. But it all seemed natural to me. It just seemed like, every mistake that I like there's a few things I've renounced in my previous views, which we've probably all done. But every time it's been something where I just took the word for some guru, like yeah. someone who said this, like Ayn Rand said, libertarians are evil. So she had taught me so much. I thought, okay, she must be right. So for a year or two at LSU, I remember in 1984 at LSU, I was Louisiana State University in the beginning. So I went to LSU, double E degree guy. Then I went to law school there, but I was an engineer. And in 1980, maybe it's 88, Ron Paul was running for president, and Ron Paul came through campus, and Ron Paul had a little talk sponsored by the LSU Libertarian Party guys or whatever. And I went to it because I was trying to get interested in this stuff. And I remember I sat in the room, I bet this was 88, and this must be 88.
Yeah, that's when he ran for the LP.
So he was in a classroom at LSU, and I went in there, and I was kind of like still under the Randian sway. And I was really heavily pro-abortion at this point. Like, and I had some sense, and I think the Libertarian Party generally is pro-choice, like Rand would be. But Ron Paul was a slight exception because, you know, everyone's got their deviations or whatever. But you could tell, like, if that's your issue, abortion, which it wasn't my issue, but I noticed it, like, they say things that, like, you could say, wait a minute. So, like, do you really agree with the Libertarian Party platform view on abortion? Because it doesn't sound like you do. So I was in the classroom, and I was hostile to the Libertarian Party because Rand had excoriated libertarians as being enemies of reason and all this kind of stuff. Like, I think I'm totally wrong. I mean, she was totally wrong. They were basically the offshoot of the political part of philosophy. She just didn't like competition.
Yeah, you're hitting on a couple things that I totally agree with, because I remember at one point, you know, probably a decade ago, you know, new libertarian, they're always the most zealous, you know, think I know everything, still kind of, yeah. you know, under that cult of personality vibe where it's like, I think this because these people say this thing or that person says this, you know, and Mary Ruart looked at me and kind of embarrassed me in front of the room, rightfully so, by saying, like, I've been around longer than you. I'm on the train. Right. If there's a train, you just hopped on and I'm way further ahead down that road. And as you become, the longer you go, the more you understand individualism. You start to think for yourself. You start to peel these little pieces of other people's opinions away and start to examine things. I think that's really, you know, and that's, we're in an era of the cult of personality, which kind of highlights this and makes individualists crazy sometimes. But I think you've hit on that, and that's something that new libertarians ought to understand, is that just be open-minded, because you may not think what you think a decade from now.
Right. And so Ron Paul was in the room, and I raised my hands and I said, I was just trying to get clarity, like, because I was like strongly pro-abortion at the time. Like, I was like Randian, like I'm thinking, like, maybe Rand is right that these libertarians they're not objectivist because they're not for the right, you know, the right to choose, or whatever you want to call it, pro-choice. And I noticed that Ron Paul was evading or avoiding the issue, which he was. I think he was, because that's not his primary issue. It was the Fed or whatever, you know, or spending. Right. But I was suspicious. To me, I was trying to figure out whether Rand was right. So I raised my hand and I talked to Ron, and I was like, what exactly is your view on abortion? Something like that, you know, like I'm trying to like nail him down. Not a gotcha, but just trying to figure out. And he gave this mealy mouth Ron Paul type response, right, which you would expect. And I just shut up as a student and went away. But after that, I became pretty much a libertarian because I started thinking like, oh my God, this is the Libertarian Party is basically not the party, but the libertarian philosophy is the capitalism or the political philosophy wing of objectivism. They just don't want to admit that, right? So I totally started disagreeing with Peter Schwartz and all these crazy objectivists who hated libertarians, right? And became a libertarian, and then I became an anarchist after reading more and more. I mean, you know the old joke, like what's the difference between a minarchist and an anarchist is 6 months.
Yeah.
Something like that. And that was basically the case for me. So I kind of was like introduced to objectivism and libertarianism as a high school, say, junior in 1982. And by 1988 or so, when I was getting out of law school or in law school, I basically was becoming an anarchist. And I've been that ever since. And the whole time I was reading Austrian economics, which I think is a big part of it. So that was my progression. But to me, it's not interesting. What's less interesting is the progression of ideas, but how you integrate it with your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like for me, I kind of integrate it with my life because I had a law career, and I could publish articles that would count for prominence and client development. So you could blend these things. So I tried to do a careful balancing act of all this kind of stuff. And then at the same time, so this is around, say, 1988, 89, 90. Then I became a lawyer in 1992, started practicing, became a patent lawyer in 1993, 94. And at the same time, I started becoming heavily opposed to the patent and the copyright system because of my thinking and research into these issues. At the same time that I was taking the patent bar and becoming a licensed patent lawyer, and I'm just a young lawyer at big law firms, and you know, I'm thinking, how do I divide these things up? Like, how do I split these interests apart? How do I segregate them so that I don't get in trouble?
Yeah.
But then I realized after a certain point, I mean, 5, 2, 3, 5, 10 years later, you realize no one cares. I mean,
right.
surprisingly, there's total freedom of, I won't say freedom of speech, but whatever you call it, but no one cares. If you're a good hotshot lawyer at a big law firm and you know your shit, no one cares what your personal, it's like no one cares what your sexual preference or your religion is. They don't really care. They really don't, which is one good thing about the West, I think. They really don't. And likewise, they don't care what your personal opinion is about what the patent law should be like. They just want to know that you can do the law and you can represent their case and you understand it. And in fact, if you stand up and you have a loud opinion opposing the system, lots of people think you know your shit. They assume that, oh, I mean, I can't tell you how many times in the last 20 years I've gotten calls from people, some libertarians, some not. Hey, Mr. Kinsella, I really like your anti-patent law stuff. I've got an idea for a new invention. Could you help me do it? Like, it's like switch, switch, switch. But the reason is because they're libertarians, number one. So they think they need a libertarian lawyer, which they're wrong about. But they see that they know someone they trust and they know is not evil and who knows his shit.
Yeah.
And they know that if they want a patent and I can get a patent for them, I know how to do it. It doesn't matter that I disagree with the system. Like, if you criticize the system, it means you must know the system, how to navigate the system.
You at least have an interest in ascertaining how the system works And this is one thing that I was curious about, because you went to school to be an engineer and you ended up a lawyer. And before, because I want to dive into patent law and spend a lot more time on copyright and stuff like that. But, you know, briefly, is there an overlap between, you know, the engineering systems and that systematic way of thinking and the law in general? Was it a natural kind of click between the two, of the way that your brain worked in that engineering mode into the law?
I mean, I can only speak for myself, but of course I only am. I hate these disclaimers people do when they say, I'm only speaking for myself. I'm like, yeah, who else would you be speaking for? But to say that, what I'm saying is maybe other engineers or lawyers might not agree. But my take is this. Well, first of all, there's a misconception. So you said something I've heard many times over the years, okay, which is, why did you switch? Now, most people don't understand that, like, so let's just take the U.S., the American case. In the U.S. since 1960 or 50 or whatever, the law degree has been a second degree, a JD, not an LLB. It used to be an LLB, a first degree, like it still is in England and some other countries. But now it's a doctorate or a graduate degree, like a medical degree. Which means that to be a lawyer in the U.S., you have to get a JD. To get a JD, you have to have a first degree, a bachelor's of something, English, history, philosophy, or even engineering. So there's no connection between them, but it is a second degree, right? You follow me?
Yeah, that makes sense. And that makes sense that you'd understand technical systems and then go into something like patent or copyright. Yeah.
Well, so to be a patent lawyer, the way it works is to be a lawyer, you have to be licensed to practice in a state. So most lawyers pretty much every lawyer will say, yeah, I'm licensed in Texas or California or Louisiana or whatever. And to be a patent lawyer, you have to have the patent bar. So you have to take a bar, what they call a bar exam. By the way, do you know the reason they use the word bar?
Isn't it from the barristers in England? I know it's from England, but I don't remember the origin story.
Well, so like if you think of a courtroom, like you imagine there's a section of the courtroom geographically or physically spaced out. You know, you have the judge, and then you have a section for the jury, and then a section for the spectators and a section for the lawyers. And then there's like physically like a little pivoting post that you have to go through to get into this one chamber near the judge that's called the bar. So like to pass the bar, like literally means you have the right to pass that bar. Anyway, I love etymology and crazy crap like this because I'm an engineer and I resent what I didn't study in. But anyway, my point was, most people think that when you go from engineering to law, it's a switch, but it's not a switch because in America today, to be a lawyer, you have to have some first degree, some 4-year bachelor's degree, a BA or a BS in something. It doesn't matter what it is. Like there's no, like when I thought about going to law school, like I was a fourth year engineering student or maybe a grad student and I got my master's in engineering too. Maybe I was a grad student. My wife, I'll tell you a story. Do you want to hear personal stories or, I mean, what do you want to hear? Cause I don't want to go, cause I'll tell you like an interesting anecdote. Okay.
Well, go ahead.
I was at my then girlfriend's house at her father was a chemical engineer, manager of a chemical plant, very smart guy, having dinner with them. I was a grad student in electrical engineering, getting my master's in electrical engineering. And I did that because I didn't want to leave. I got my first offer from General Dynamics to work on these jets. And I didn't want to leave my girlfriend who was going to be in school for a while, all that kind of stuff. So I just said, I'll just get a master's degree, see what happens. This is like 1988. And my wife's father says something like, my wife, who's very ambitious, she's very smart, but she wasn't hyper smart like me. So she thought I was going to be the millionaire. My wife turns out to be the one that makes all the money in the family. But anyway, that's the way it goes. Ambition exceeds IQ, put it that way.
Yeah.
But anyway, so my wife, we're sitting at the dinner table, and my wife says, Stefan, you're really smart. Why don't you go to medical school? Oh, I remember what happened. Her father had just come back from his high school reunion in Florida, where he met one of his old classmates. He was from Pennsylvania, and he met one of his classmates who was like a doctor that worked on the knees of these athletes in Florida. And he was making like $350,000 a year. This is back in 1988. That's a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
And he was working like 2 or 3 days a week just doing knee surgery on athletes. You know, there's these specialties that you can make a lot of money, and there's others that can make even more, right, in medicine. And my girlfriend says, Stefan, you're smart. Why don't you go to medical school? I said, well, I don't really like biology, and I don't know if I have the prerequisites to go to medical school, or it would take a lot longer. And she goes, huh, what else could you do if you're smart and make a lot of money, more than an engineer? I said, I don't know. She goes, well, you like to argue with people. What about being a lawyer? I said, I don't know. I said, I don't think that – I think you have to have a pre-law degree. That's what inspired this anecdote, because I was so naive. I thought you had to have a pre-law degree to go to law school.
Right.
But it's not. You have to have an undergraduate degree, but it doesn't matter what it is. So I kind of said something like, I said, I don't know. I don't know if I'm smart. I don't know if I have enough intelligence or education to go to law school, because I was intimidated by it. And her father started laughing, because he was a plant manager for a plant and smart, and he had been around lawyers, and he started laughing. Like, he was like, dude, lawyers are not that smart. I'm like, no. He said, you're a double E. Trust me, it's double E is way harder than law school. If you want to do law school, you can do it, but don't think that it's too hard. So the next day, I walked across the campus at LSU, and I went to the LSU Law School, which I'd never been to, and I made an appointment with the chancellor, and I said, can I go to law school? Do I need to get like a pre-law degree? He said, no, you're all right. You can do it. He goes, however, engineers have a tough time in law school, which is total bullshit. It turns out, he said that to me, and I'm like, okay. So I took the LSAT, I scored well, and I went to law school. That's what happened. But he was totally wrong, I think. Like, most engineers that I know did well in law school. And here's the reason. Engineering is analytical. I'm sorry, it is quantitative. However, it's analytical. It's problem solving. Like, the goal of engineering is to solve a problem, like to figure out what the answer to the problem is. And the same thing is true in law, except it's verbal and it's qualitative, not quantitative. But the goal is the same. It's problem solving. So you have these English majors, let's say, who go to law school. They never learned problem solving. They were never analytical. You know, they're analyzing a text and giving some kind of woo-woo analysis of a text, which no one can ever judge is right or wrong. It's not a problem solving issue.
Right.
So the engineers, they might have been a little bit some of the engineers who go to law school might be a little bit behind, because a lot of engineers are not good at communication, like writing and communicating. But that's kind of a symptom of some engineers. But they're not all that stupid. Like, some people can actually communicate, and you learn to write a letter or an email. It's not that hard, or a paper.
It's like Office Space. I talk to the public for the engineers. They can't. I'm in between.
Yeah. But if you have an engineer who knows how to communicate, I don't think law school's honestly, it's not that hard. I mean, compared to engineering. So that was my story about, and I love law school, by the way. I loved it. Most of my classmates hated it. So I was always amazed that they were hating it, but I was loving everything about it. Cause to me, it was like I loved engineering too, but I was like, I was being released from the strictures of mathematics and calculations. We could talk in human terms about real problems. You know what I mean? Like in verbal terms. So I loved it all. I loved all of it. I loved all my 9 years of college. So I'm one of these people that's weird. I just loved college.
Yeah, I do too. This is my first semester back since 2005 to finish my degree. And I think because I thought back and I was like, I really loved the process of learning. I love doing this show because it's, you know, it's a research paper every week. But I would be remiss. So I work in radio now, and I've worked in the creative industry my whole career. And I think like most people who kind of work in my field or in the public, you sort of go, well, you know, I don't want anybody to steal my work. You know, and I saw you wrote an article that I'll put in the show notes titled "Do Patents and Copyrights Undermine Private Property?" which I thought was an interesting title because I think of We Are Libertarians as my property, right? Like if somebody tried to steal the name and start a Facebook page like 5 years ago and, you know, and obviously people would realize that this was the thing that was started 10 years ago and so you have the social proof whereas the other people wouldn't. But you sort of go, hey, what are you doing? You know, so I think that idea of I created this thing, I'm putting it out there, this is my brand. But then I also recognize that's all kind of amorphous. And really what I do is just listen a lot, read a lot, take in a lot of things. You know, there's nothing new under the sun necessarily about, you know, it's all the same chords if you're playing music. I mean, what is it not private property? What protection should a person have in terms of copyright? How would it work in a free market system? Just give me like the basics of it and we'll start there, I think. Is that too broad of a question?
No. It's just that I've dealt with this question probably literally 1,000 times and I'm always trying to think of like what's the best and it depends on the audience too, but so I remember Jeff Tucker, who you probably know mm-hmm. of.
Yep.
A good old buddy of mine from the old days. He was telling, I mean, Jeff Tucker. So when I started thinking, hard about the IP stuff, intellectual property, patent, copyright, that kind of stuff, the stuff you're mentioning, but you're also mentioning, by the way, you might not know it, but you're mentioning related things like trademark and plagiarism, like all kinds of, and fraud, sure. Things that are all not the same thing, but that's what happens. People mix them together. I started thinking about this because I was always uncomfortable as a budding libertarian thinker, like a guy reading from the outside, like starting in college. I was always uncomfortable with Rand's argument for patent and copyright. Something about it, like I'm like this, like I assume she was correct because she's a genius and everyone else is in favor of patent and copyright and it's part of the American Western capitalist system, so it's got to be right, but the arguments just don't quite make sense, right?
Which are to summarize, sort of like, you know, I mix my labor and time and materials and, you know, skill set all into this one thing, and then, you know, I should have some ownership over that.
Something like that. That's the argument for it. But then but what they're arguing for was a system that would be like a limited set of rights that would extend to some things but not others by legislation. Like it would extend to like maps and paintings, but not databases. And it would extend to machines and airplanes and the light bulb and the transistor, but not to E equals MC squared. And they would expire after a certain point in time, like 17 years, or in the case of copyright, 14 years, then 28, then 58, and now 100 and whatever. But the point is, it's like everything about it was arbitrary. It's like, why would they expire after a certain point in time? How do you know what that should be? And why are some things covered and some things not? So something about it didn't make sense to me, right? So I thought, something is wrong with this. And I just, you know, I'm a nobody. I'm just some libertarian law student who is listening and reading and thinking. But then I became a lawyer and I started writing and publishing. And then I became an IP lawyer itself, a patent lawyer, registered patent attorney. So I actually understand how patent law works now, and copyright and trademark and all these things. And I'm thinking, like, I need to figure this shit out, because it's not a moral issue. Like, I'm enforcing it and working in it. I need to, like, know whether I should do it or not. Hmm. Although that might have been part of it. It was more like, I'm the only guy that can do it. I mean, I'm not saying I'm the only guy who can do it, but, like, who else is going to do it? So people criticize me sometimes for being a hypocrite. Like, oh, you're a patent lawyer and then you're against the patent system. I'm like, well, let's assume the patent system is illegitimate. Who do you think is going to realize that and be able to explain it and figure it out, other than someone who actually understands the system?
Who can
that
find
probably
that?
Yeah. Is going to be a practitioner who's an expert, like I am and was. I mean, so around the same time, I started, like, getting my bars passed and practicing law, getting my patent bar, learning about it. I started reading more and more and more and more and more about IP law issues, and I was determined to figure it out. I thought, like, okay, all these other guys have bad arguments. Ayn Rand has a bad argument for it, you know, Coase, whoever has a bad argument for it, but I will find the right argument. I will solve the IP issue. I will be the one that will solve. I will explain to people why we need patent law and copyright law and why it's okay. But the more I looked into it, I kept, butting my head against the wall and failing. And it's not because I'm stupid. I'm still pretty sure about that. That wasn't the problem. I might be stupid, but that wasn't the reason. But the reason was because I was trying to prove the impossible. It's like I was trying to prove 2 + 2 = 5. I was trying to do that. And I tried a million different ways. And I finally realized, oh, here's why you can't prove 2 + 2 = 5, because it's not. I finally realized, I had an epiphany, like, oh, I've been trying to prove something that is basically unjust, like, the whole time. So I came to a realization right around the same time that I passed the patent bar and started doing it. Like, the whole thing was total bullshit and unjust. So then my question was, like, what do I do? Like, can I announce this? Will this hurt my career? You know? And so I kind of tepidly put my foot in the water. I did one or two talks, and I'd be like, well, here's one argument for, here's one argument against, you know, thinking, like, if there's a big backlash, I can kind of, like, back off. But there never was a backlash, because no one – the only people that care are libertarians, really, or people that are victims of it. The lawyers don't care. Your clients don't care. As I said, being against IP has gotten me clients in the past. So because to them it's a signature that – It's a guarantee that you know your stuff.
Well, it's also, like you said, that intellectual courage to say out loud what you truly believe, knowing that there may be some consequences to it. If you're willing to be an IP lawyer that says all of this is bullshit, there is some courage there, and I imagine that's attractive. I mean, that's got to be.
I think it's not just that. It's that if you have the credentials that I had, which was, you know, big firms and whatever, then they know that you're not like just trying to spout off. Like, they know that you must know what you're talking about. You must have enough courage of your convictions to know what you're talking about. So all they care about is it's a certification that you're an expert, basically, I think. I don't know. I haven't interviewed all these people that have contacted me. But anyway, I found it an interesting process. I forgot where we're going with all this, I found the whole thing interesting.
Yeah. So what was the solution? What is the solution? I mean, if you write a piece of music, if you write a book, like how do you maintain rights without everybody just ripping you off and stealing your stuff?
Yeah. So I mean, I literally did a 7, 8, 9 hour Mises course on this about 10 years ago. Because it takes a long time to unpack all this, because everything you just said is like a presupposition that I think is wrong. Like just using the word stealing, or even the presupposition of saying, how do I do this? How do I make sure I make money? Like the purpose of political philosophy and philosophers, they're not bound to tell entrepreneurs how they can make a profit in a world where competition is possible. That's the job of entrepreneurs, right? Like number one. So if you say, how can I be a poet and make money off poetry? It's like, okay, that's interesting. That's a question. But a question is not an argument. So that's one of the first things I think you have to recognize. Questions are not arguments. So if you just bark out at someone, how am I supposed to make money selling my new light bulb idea if I don't have patents? If you just bark that out, I don't really know if that's an honest, sincere, genuine question, because it's basically a way of saying it's sort of like when socialists or welfare advocates say something like, okay, you libertarians say that in a free market, there'd be very little poverty, and what little poverty there is remaining would be handled by charity. Show me proof of that.
Right. It's fear-based in my
mind. Well, it's what they want. They want a guarantee. They want you to guarantee that, like, some poor fireman's daughter who's killed in an accident is going to be able to go to college. And if you can't guarantee that, then they're going to say, fine, fuck you. I'm going to take the welfare state. It's like, well, but because once you start saying that, calm down, everyone simmer down, if we get rid of Medicare, Medicaid, and the welfare state, and we get rid of public schools and private and public libraries, there will be private libraries and private schools, and the Catholic Church will come in. If you kind of give them these ideas about what a free society might look like, what they will do is they'll say, give me a goddamn guarantee. And if you can't give them a guarantee, they'll say, fine, then I'm going to keep taxing you, and I'm going to make it my guarantee. And of course, our answer would be, excuse me, well, what's your guarantee? I mean, because, you know, the government's probably going to be bankrupt and run out of money, and there might be a revolution, and Medicare, Medicaid, yeah. Like, you don't have a guarantee either, so it's all bullshit.
One of the better arguments...
Everyone wants a guarantee. There's no guarantees in life.
Yeah, that and the turnaround of that is always... It's already happening in society. We have all this government, and we have all of these, you know, supposed guarantees because of the law, and yet the bad actor still exists. In fact, well, you're probably creating more of them.
So take the copyright or patent case. People have these false assumptions about the way copyright and patent work. Like, they think that, like, well, if you don't have copyright and patent, I like doing a hick accent to, like, make fun of them, you know. But what's going to make sure that I'm going to get paid for my screenplay? or my invention, the little guy, and it's like, well, first of all, the patent and copyright system don't guarantee that anyway. All they do is give you a legal right to go to court if you can afford the lawyers to stop someone from competing with you. Now, I will concede that that gives you an advantage in the free, in the market, because it converts a free market to a monopolized or monopsonized market, right? Where probably monopolized, where like you're the only seller of this good. But even that doesn't guarantee anyone wants to buy your shit. You know, if Apple has a monopoly on a rounded corner iPhone, that does give them an advantage because no one can compete with them. But it still doesn't guarantee them an income, because if no one wants to buy that, they're not going to buy it. They wouldn't have bought that in 1972 because it wouldn't have worked. You know what I mean? It's like, so the patent and copyright system don't guarantee money to anyone. It just helps them repress competition. So that's the essential thing people need to understand about IP, is that patent and copyright law are basically totally contrary and counter to private property rights, individual liberty, free markets, competition, innovation, dynamism, modernism. So you got to stop and think about this. You have to think, oh, maybe I'm wrong. So if a little girl so the reason I brought up Jeff Tucker, like my friend Jeff Tucker thought I was crazy when I wrote this IP stuff a long time ago. And then he read it and he thought, oh, Kinsella's right.
Which is funny, because so, you know, Jeffrey Tucker, when Jeffrey Tucker was on the show in 2013, he's the reason we have Creative Commons on our website, because Tucker was the one who in 2013 was like, don't put all rights reserved on there. What are you doing? You're libertarians. And he explained some of this stuff to us. So right. It's funny.
Right. And that was in the aftermath of all this kind of stuff. But he gave me this example, like one of his little girls, like went to school and she had like come up with a new hairdo or something, like the way she tied her hair. And it was kind of cool and all the kids liked it. And then she went to school the next day and another girl had the same thing. And she came home crying to daddy, like, this girl stole my haircut. So it was like a little micro example of this IP mentality. Now, of course, the other girl didn't steal anything. She emulated her. She learned. She copied, right? Like, I probably have the example mangled, but it was something like that. So, but the point is, when you say if a new business crops up or someone does something and they steal my idea, they're actually not stealing it. That's the word we use, and we use that word because it has negative connotations, because actual stealing is actually bad. Like raping is bad, which is why the word date rape has become, you know, like the whole thing, like people, they glom onto things that have it's like equivocation. So I guess my point is, if someone copies you, competes with you, emulates you, learns from you, they're not stealing, because they didn't take anything that you own. And if you say that you own the way you're doing business or whatever, then you're begging the question, because the question is, what is ownership? Do you really own that? So,
yeah, and I think the internet provides a great example of people have a very closed-fisted view of the world. Oftentimes they kind of think, I need to keep – there's only so much pie. You know, if you take this piece of the pie, then I'm going to lose this piece, as opposed to an ever expanding. I actually just reread Leonard Reed's iPencil, you know, talking about there is no central planner for the pencil. It's over the long period of time, it's developed into the pencil, and you have all these various people collaborating to make the pencil to perfect it over time. Mm-hmm. You know, and the internet gives so many great examples of, you know, things like this, where I can start up something, build an audience. I've made a lot of mistakes. I've made a few successes. You know, I'm learning. I'm getting better. I'm, you know, putting in reps. I'm helping other people, you know, build their podcast, that sort of thing. You know, it's much more of an open mindset. And the less regulation, the less control there is on the internet, it shows you how much growth and how much opportunity. And of course, there's problems with something, but the internet, I think, really kind of highlights the ideas that you're talking about and shows innovation can be a powerful tool, you know, once you get out of the way of it and stop letting people protect it. Am I on target there?
I don't disagree with anything you just said, but what you just made me think of was something that's maybe a little bit, I admit that when I talk and what we just talked about, I'm a little bit abstruse sometimes. And I, but you know, if someone's interested in ideas and they want to think about it, that's fine. But I mean, how much are you or your audience into the basic ideas of, say, Austrian economics theory?
I would say interested. Probably, you know, we don't talk a lot about it here because we talk more issues, but I, you know, we're interested, yes.
Okay, because I think that the way to really understand this is, so Mises, Ludwig von Mises, who I think is probably one of the greatest thinkers, certainly the greatest economist, but maybe one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century, his basic way of looking at things. Now, I'm going to introduce a word which will sound off-putting to people, like a lot of these coined terms did to me when I learned them when I was younger. But over time, you learn that some of them make sense. And his word is praxeology, okay? So forget about the word, but that's the word he used to describe his thinking about economics and what economics is and how to understand human action and what humans do, right? Economic activity. And all it meant was the logic of human action. And really all that means to me, and I'm going to focus on, it means that you have to, we're all human actors. Every person has a body and we're an actor in this world of scarce resources. We all have a limited time on the earth. And we try to achieve successive goals over time, right? Which means that we don't know what the future is. We don't know what's coming. The future's uncertain. But we have a general awareness of what the situation is like and what it might be, what we need to do to intervene in the state of affairs to achieve our goals. This is what human action is. This is what economics is about. It's about analyzing the consequences of this general structure of human action. So basically, human action is the fact that people have bodies and they employ scarce resources to achieve goals in the future. So, I mean, people don't think like this. Like, they think, if I want to kiss my daughter, I want to kiss my daughter. You know, if I want to make a meal, I make a meal. But really, everything is time-oriented. Everything is aimed at the future. So, like, as Mises calls it, you have felt uneasiness. Like, you have some idea about what's happening in the next 5 minutes, the next 2 minutes, the next 10 minutes, the next year. And you envision that if you don't intervene or do something, what's going to happen is not going to be what you want. Like, if you don't intervene in the next 10 minutes, you won't have a cheese sandwich to eat and your hunger will become insatiable, whatever, right? So you take an action, and so this is the general structure of what humans do. But the general structure, which Mises calls praxeology, so forget about the word, it's a Greek word, it's a Greek informed coinage, but it means the logic of human action. But what it means is that every time we human beings do something, that we act, we control our bodies to manipulate things that are within our possession, right? And we do that to achieve something in the future. We're trying to change the future. We're trying to create a new future, to be honest, right? We're trying to make a future exist that won't exist without our intervention, right? So the whole purpose of human life, not the purpose of human life, but what human beings do is that they have purposes that they try to fulfill by acting, by manipulating resources. Now, the thing about this that is underemphasized, I believe, in economics is the knowledge aspect. Because to be an actor, to be a human being that acts, yeah, you have to have the ability. You can't be Stephen Hawking in a wheelchair who can't do anything. You have to have the ability to control your body and therefore some other resources in the world to extend yourself into the world, right? Which is a whole nother discussion, the property rights discussion. But you also have to be knowledge. You have to have knowledge. So there's two things. So this simplistic, I think it's simplistic or simple, understanding of the way of our relationship as human actors to the universe leads you to realize that, number one, we have to have control or possession or use of resources, but you also have to have knowledge or information, because you can't use something to make a fire if you don't know that can make a fire. So you need knowledge, and you need the things that can make the fire. So you need access to the things. So property rights control one. They control the things that we need to access and use and manipulate. But we also need knowledge. Now, once you understand human action and human society in this fashion, I think it helps to, well, this is my view. Human progress has come about because primarily of the increase of knowledge over time, especially in the last 200 plus years of the Industrial Revolution. We finally reached a tipping point where all this scientific technological knowledge has compounded on itself, and everyone has more and more knowledge of ways to causally manipulate the things, the scarce things in the world, in the universe, right, to achieve our results, which is why intellectual property law, namely, let's say patent law, is so evil, is because we have two central components of human society prospering and living together in a growing, expanding society. One is our ability to control the universe, and the other is our knowledge of what we need to do. And we need property rights for the first, because these are scarce, rivalrous resources, right? That's why we have property rights. That's why we have law. That's why we have conflict and fighting among people, and law and property rights are meant to temper that and give us some security and the ability to employ these resources, which we need to use because our bodies aren't enough, and even our bodies are scarce resources. But on the other hand, the body of human knowledge can keep expanding without limit. And to impose property rights on something that's non-scarce, in other words, knowledge that we have that could be duplicated by billions or trillions or quadrillions of whatever of people at the same time in a future world, it's a good thing. To try to impose scarcity, which is what IP law tries to do. So IP law, property law deals with the fact that we have scarcity in the real world, in the physical, tangible world. This is the way our universe works. Given this scarcity, we have to have property rights to help us manage it and to use it the most efficient way possible. That's all fine. But then what IP law does is it tries to duplicate this realm with using the force of law in the abstract or intellectual or informational realm where there is no scarcity. So they're actually trying to impose scarcity on things that are not scarce just to make it manageable by their existing systems. But what they're doing is they're hampering the second half of the key ingredient of human prosperity and flourishing, which is the proliferation and spread and use of knowledge. So anything that prevents the spread of knowledge and learning and competition on the free market, which is what patent and copyright law do, is completely anti-life, evil, and horrible. This is why I'm so passionate about it. I mean, I really think that we would be living in a Jetsons age at this point. And maybe we will be in the future, but we shouldn't retard it by imposing artificial restrictions on the development of knowledge that the human race needs to make us great and powerful and prosperous.
That's beautiful. That's perfect. I mean, that, and it makes total sense. The, you know, look at the medical industry, and you look at just a very real example with, you know, the testing for the coronavirus. CDC centralizes that to one point of success or one point of failure instead of letting the 20 labs collaborate, coordinate, you know, do their own thing. And that would have been 20 points of success or failure as opposed to one. You know, that is just one recent illustration, I think, of the dam that is often put in place, you know, for whose protection, for whose benefit. You know, usually very deep pockets, but really just, I don't know, what is it? Is it just for the conquest of the ability to have power over an idea, the ability to protect an economic position? What you just explained is so rational, logical, and makes so much sense, why don't we do it?
I've struggled with finding a way to explain what went wrong. My theory is that we went wrong with Locke. And I don't blame Locke, and I understand why Locke became popular, but basically the labor theory, like, it's basically the imprecise use of, well, it's lack of consistency in principle, but in this particular case, it's the labor theory of value or property. So Locke, John Locke, who is seen as and thought of by us as our hero, he was trying to fight the power of the state, which was a monarchical thing, which rested upon this myth of that God had given Earth to the monarchs, you know, by the Adam and Eve story, like, to simplify, right? So he was trying to come up with some defense against that serfdom mentality, this hierarchical statist mentality, right? And so what he said was, well, let's take for granted the Adam and Eve story and the Old Testament and the Bible, because you had to at that time. So God gave the earth to Adam. Adam was the first prince of the earth. Procreation happened after that, after God committed genocide in the flood, of course, which no one notices. I don't know why people don't recognize God as like some mortal enemy of humanity, because he's a mortal threat. He's like an existential threat to humanity, right? He's threatening to kill everyone if they don't. He actually did kill everyone except for like 9 people or whatever in the flood. Anyway, but the idea is that so. But God gave everyone ownership of themselves, whatever that means, which wasn't, by the way, full ownership, because God still owns you. Like, so the idea was like, let's assume God is the creator and God owns everyone. So God owns you. So you're God's slave, but we're going to assume God is benevolent. So he's not going to subjugate you, although he might, because he killed everyone in the flood. But Locke was trying to come up with a way to fight the monarchical powers, to limit them, to say that they're not absolute, they don't have absolute power. So it's like God gave everyone ownership of themselves, and he gave ownership of the whole world to Adam, but it wasn't used yet, so it was in commons, blah, blah, blah. So therefore, if you mix your labor with it, then you can own it, and then you're independent of the power of the sovereign, and et cetera. So it was a sort of a decentralist argument, but he had to come up with this labor theory idea, like, oh, well, you own yourself because God gave you ownership for yourself, so you own your labor, therefore you own what you mix it with. So you result in this kind of kludge hodgepodge of ideas. So I honestly think the big mistake we made was the Lockean idea of labor theory of property, which I do think ended up resulting in the labor theory of value of Karl Marx and Ricardo and communism, right? And it resulted in the intellectual property ideas that we have now. So when you start thinking of property as the result of your labor, then you get this whole confusion about, well, I mean, think about the physics idea. In physics, what's work? Work is force over a distance or something like that, right? That's one definition. So if I push on a wall and I don't move it, I didn't do any work, right? But I still expended my labor, like sweating. And you'll see this in patent law and copyright law, the sweat of the brow. It's called the sweat of the brow doctrine. If you sweat, it means if you labor, if I spend money developing a map that shows the streets of, you know, some county in New York, then I should have a property right in that. It's almost this Protestant work ethic idea. Like, if you spend your time doing effort, then you have a property right in it. Like, there's so many confused ideas. It's almost like a communist idea, like, oh, well, okay, just pay these guys a dollar a day to use a spoon to dig a trench. They're doing work, you know. So the labor theory of value, the labor theory of property, all in a sense meld together. And I don't blame John Locke or his followers, but I do believe that was the main intellectual mistake that we've made in the Western system, is that we accepted this labor concept. Like, if I could be a dictator, I might just outlaw the whole word labor, even the word value, to be honest. I mean, it's confused economics and political theory for so long. So the only way to untangle it is to stop and think, why do we have law? What's the purpose of all this? What's the source of value? What does value mean? Is it a verb? Is it a noun? I mean, I'm more Mises-ian. I value something by demonstrating my preference towards it, by acting to achieve it. But there's not a value in the thing, which is what the Randians say, like when they support IP. They'll say the source of property rights is creation of value. Like, what does that mean? You don't create a value. There is no such thing as a value.
Right. It's more about what is someone willing to pay for it?
Yeah. It's a verb, not a noun. It's like, I value this because I demonstrate that I value it because I'm acting to achieve it. But to say a thing is of value or has a value is to sort of adopt this intrinsic primitive view of economics that things have intrinsic or objective values. Nothing has an objective value.
Well, so, you know, I want to be respectful of your time. We're already 30 minutes over, and but I've loved this. It's been a phenomenal conversation. Where can people find more of your work if they want to follow you? If they, I know you said you had a podcast. What podcast are you on? How can people follow your work and get more of the information that you presented?
Well, so I don't really have, I don't have a real podcast. I just have an RSS feed which collects things like this. But I have a website, stephankinsella.com, and I do have a collection of articles over the years which basically outline the things we've talked about today, which I'm editing into a book, which will be out in probably two months. And it's called Law in a Libertarian World. And you can find it at stephankinsella.com/LLW, Law in a Libertarian World. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Very good. I'd love to have you back and talk more about that and cover that, because I think that's one thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately is that people often think that, oh, if there's no government, there will be no law. There will be no mitigation of problems. There will be no, it'll just be Somalia. And that's just not the case. There is arbitration. There is a way to settle things, and how that would operate is definitely of interest to me and to our audience. So love to have you back and love to converse about that. And I will put all of this stuff in the show notes so you can follow everything. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you for listening to We Are Libertarians, and we will talk to you very soon. Thank you.